There's a song by an American singer-songwriter, a lady called Gretchen Peters, that starts with two men sitting in a bar, ruminating on the meaning of life, and wondering whether life is just about working and drinking and dreaming. And the chorus declares that the secret of life is a good cup of coffee, or keeping your eye on the ball, or putting up a poster of a beautiful woman. The bartender puts it another way. The secret of life is that there isn't one. We're into week two of Ecclesiastes. Last week was a kind of introductory sermon. If you missed it, it's on the website. You can either download it or listen to it on the website, or you can speak to Andrew and he can let you have a copy. Ecclesiastes is one of these books that sort of loops on itself a lot, and actually it'll be helpful for the whole series if you get a chance to listen to that first sermon that sort of sets some of the, I guess, not ground rules as such, but introduces it and introduces some of the themes and some of where we're going. So say, if you get a chance, either on the website or speak to Andrew and he can get you a CD. But I just want to reiterate two things, that I said last week, one now and one in a minute. That word meaningless that we hear time and again, and we heard it many times this morning in that reading, as I said last week, I'm not sure that's a great translation of the word. The Old Testament's originally written in Hebrew, and what we have here is a translation, and translating from one language to another, as those of you who speak more than one language, is not always easy and not always straightforward, particularly when the language is very ancient and said in another culture and all that. But that word, it's the word hevel, H-E-V-E-L, and initially it meant something like vapor or fog. It refers to something that is fleeting, something that passes, something transient, something which makes no permanent impression or impact. You can see where they got meaningless from, but I'm not convinced meaningless carries sort of a meaning of its own, if you like, which is not always, it is not always helpful. So when you see meaningless, there's all that meaning behind the word, as it were. And chapter 2, the speaker is, I've called him Koheleth. That's the Hebrew word for the book. That's the Hebrew word that's translated Ecclesiastes. In chapter 1, he's referred to as the teacher, but he's much more than a teacher. He's a poet. He's a preacher. He's a philosopher. He's a poet, and I believe he's a pastor. So I find it helpful to just call him Koheleth, because that name catches all those bits. He's describing a kind of journey, his journey. He's out to discover the meaning of life. Rather than sitting in the bar with two of his mates discussing it, he goes on a great experiment, if you like, a journey. And what we have here is a kind of testimony, if you like, an autobiography describing that journey for meaning, for purpose, for life, I guess, ultimately. And as we've heard, he starts with pleasure. And another translation puts it like this. He says, let's go for it. Experiment with pleasure, he said to himself. Have a good time. But there was nothing to it. Nothing but smoke. Pleasure didn't work. Singers, concubines, all devoted to the task of pleasing him. That didn't work. It was fun for a while, but longer term, it just left him feeling empty. Big construction projects didn't work either. Houses, vineyards, gardens, parks. Other vanity projects. Success didn't work either. Slaves, flocks, power, influence. Neither did accumulation of stuff. Silver, gold. It's cheerful stuff, isn't it? I tried all these things, he said, all these things, and it was all smoke. Not that there wasn't any pleasure in those things in and of themselves. He's not saying that. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. Maybe that's the motto text of our culture. At least one of them, isn't it? For many in our culture. I desired myself nothing. But then he says, my heart took delight in all my work. And this was the reward for all my labour. He did find pleasure, but it was just so fleeting. So transitory. Like trying to catch the wind. Have you ever done that? Windy day, go outside, get a jam jar maybe, hold it up to the wind, and then put the lid on. I've got it, I've caught the wind. And then you go inside and you open the jam jar, and what have you got? Air, probably. Nothing. Koheleth is looking for something substantial, something meaningful, something that is worth orientating your life around. But it all felt just like chasing the wind. You ain't never going to catch the wind. Why? Well, because of this hevel word, the hevelness of things, if you like. Things do not last. They do not continue. The things that we depend on for happiness can become occasions for disappointment and grief. Joy is not something that we can guarantee or that we can manufacture or that we can make happen. And of course, in the background lurks death. And I'm going to speak about death later in the series because Koheleth comes back to it again and again. In a sense, the reality of death, though, hovers over his life and his search for pleasure. He's aware that one day this will all end. And then what? And maybe there's a sense, one, I was reading something this week, was saying that hevel, that sense of transitoriness, that fleetingness, maybe we should translate it as absurd, because there is an absurdity about it as well. We put so much time and so much effort into these things, and then they're gone, and there's something slightly absurd, bizarre, if you like, about it. It's all a chasing after the wind, he says. And he talks about his legacy, what happens after he's gone. I hated all the things, he said, that I toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. And yet they will have control over the fruit of my toil, which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too, he says, is hevel, meaningless, absurd, fleeting, whatever. It's probably a lesson here about the way in which we as individuals and society value and honour the legacy and the traditions that have been handed down to us. It's easy to forget the gifts that we are given from previous generations. I don't know if you saw this, but Friday morning, something deeply ironic. BBC and ITV were covering the Somme centenary service, and they cut away. They cut away to cover Michael Gove's Tory leadership speech. And you thought, that's wrong. We should be remembering. We should be remembering this event, and what these people gave, rather than what the latest news broadcast is. I don't forget, maybe that's just me, but it just felt ironic. But that sense in which we don't always receive the past with gratitude, and we're always after something new, and we forget the past too easily. And we forget tradition sometimes too quickly. But how do we honour the past? And also, when do we consider the legacy that we do leave to our children? Or is it just absurd? Sarah and I have, the rest of the kids started watching but bailed on. Have you watching a film, or watched a film over a couple of sittings? Has anybody seen the film about Schmidt? Just me then. A couple of people have seen it, yes. The film opens with this sort of panoramic view of Omaha. It is grey, it is overcast, a bit like a London summer's day. And the camera starts with this wide angle view and gradually focuses into this one tower block. Right in the middle of the city, and then it further focuses in onto one particular office in this tower block. It's the office of Warren Schmidt, and we see him sat at his desk with packing boxes behind him, with all of his files neatly stacked in a pile on the wall. And then we see Warren watching the clock as it slowly ticks around to 5 o'clock. It's his last day on his job as assistant vice president and actuary at Woodman of the World Insurance Company. Today he retires. And as the clock reaches, as the second hand reaches the 12, as it is 5 o'clock, he gets up, he turns off the light, and he goes out into the rainy night. And later in the evening, he has his retirement do. During the retirement do, his successor, this young and upward-coming executive, says to him, "You must stop by and visit sometimes. We could sure use your wisdom. Do, if you're passing, do pop in and visit sometimes." And a few days later, Warren does that. He's passing, and he pops up to see his supervisor, and basically he's ignored. Basically, things have moved on. And as he leaves, he sees his old boxes and his old files stored outside, ready to be binned. If you like, the fruit of his labour, ready to go into the bin. For a person must labour with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. It felt like such a good illustration. And after that, his life kind of unravels a bit, and his wife dies, and just life is like he's in a sense on this journey to try and make sense of all, and literally he goes on a journey. But he says this, he adopts, as it were, or sends money to a child in Tanzania, and he writes in these long letters sort of outlining what's going on in his mind and what he's feeling, and almost trying to make sense of his life through these letters to a little 6-year-old boy in Tanzania. And he says this, he says, "I know we're all pretty small in the big scheme of things, and I suppose the most you can hope for is to make a small difference. But what kind of difference have I made? What in the world is better because of me? Relatively soon I'll die. Once I'm dead and everyone who knows me dies too, it'll be as though I never existed. What difference has my life made to anyone? None that I can think of, none at all." And he says, "I hope that things are well with you. Yours truly, Warren Schmidt." I love that. He pours his heart out and he says, "Well, I hope things are well with you," this little 6-year-old lad. The thing with Colette is he doesn't dress it up. This is what the world is like. And if we pretend otherwise, in a sense, we're kidding ourselves. All this world reveres and wars to own. All Hevel. All the stuff you build your life around. Your achievements, your wants, your desires, your needs, your pleasures. If that's all there is, then so what, in a sense? So chasing after the wind, he says, it doesn't last. It's not permanent, it's not transitory. That doesn't mean there's no joy in it. That doesn't mean there's no laughter. That doesn't mean it's all bad. He's not saying that. He's not just knocking all this stuff. He says it doesn't last. It doesn't last. And yet amidst all of this, amidst all of this heaven, it can be, in some ways it can be a bit depressing to read all that. You think, oh no, give it a rest. Amidst all this, there are hints of something more. There are hints of another perspective. There are hints of another way. And we get one of these in verse 24. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? And in some ways, in his own way, that's the point that he's making. Last week, we were noticing and observing that life is fragile. That life is precious as well, and we see particularly the fragility in that passage. This week, I want to say that life is a gift to be received with thanks. Life is a gift to be received with thanks. Not to be possessed, but to be accepted. Because the truth is that we're not in control. Yes, how we live, the decisions we make, the things we say and do, the way we treat people, they're important. They affect us. But at the same time, there is so much that is beyond our control. You can't control what other people do with your work, with your legacy. You can't control how other people are going to respond to an act of kindness. You can't control the time of your death. Life is a gift. So have the humility to accept it. Something we, in a sense, receive but do not own. Koheleth is setting forward this picture of life which is about constant activity, constant accomplishment. Making, building, planting, gathering, consuming. In some ways he's the definitive consumer. And yet ultimately it was all about him. His life, his satisfaction, his purpose, his meaning. But you don't manufacture things like joy. And meaning even. You do not find these things, they find you. I often think of joy sort of creeping up behind you and tapping on you on the shoulder and saying, boo. Joy comes in unexpected places and in unexpected ways, and you can't make it happen. But you can accept it as a gift. This too I see from the hand of God, he said. Do you see the difference? I think the Apostle Paul knew that feeling as well. Paul in many ways thought he had life sussed. He thought he had God sussed. He knew what life was about. He was from the right people. From the right tribe. He'd done the right things. He kept the law. He was you can imagine this little tick list that Paul has in terms of criteria. Criteria to be a God-approved person, let's say. Right people, tick. Circumcised, tick. Persecuting the church, tick. His life made sense. His achievements were real and he took pride in them. He wanted to make a difference, tick. He wanted to live faithfully, tick. He wanted to please God, and he doesn't say it, but God must have been so impressed with him. Or so he thought. And then he met Christ. And then he met Christ. But whatever was to my profit, he says, I now consider loss. That is such an Ecclesiastes thing to say. Actually, I thought it was for profit, but actually it was all hevel. It was all for loss. Whatever were gains to me, I consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I've lost all things. I consider them garbage, that I may gain and be found in him. Garbage. Garbage is the polite translation. Paul wasn't a very polite person. And the word there is not very polite. That's what Paul thought of his self-made, self-righteous life. All, well, the word's excrement. All garbage, all excrement. All hevel. Compared with the joy of knowing Christ. All lost. And I love that phrase in verse 8, that I may be found in him. This is like Christ is his home. Not something to be gained, to be earned, not something he's worked for. A home where the lost Paul is found. Amazing grace, I was lost, but now am found. And it's all grace. Our lives as human beings, our lives as Christians are pure grace, pure gift. And Christ is our gain, a gain like no other, imperishable and undeserved. Doesn't fade, doesn't die. And we live in response to the love and grace of God. We live as people who have been found. And that doesn't mean, certainly if you look poor, that doesn't mean just sitting on our laurels, just sort of rejoicing, oh great, I've been found. Isn't this hunky-dory? Isn't this wonderful? I don't need to do anything. We live, really live, in response to the love and grace of God. We live thankfully and gracefully, acting justly, loving mercy, walking humbly with your God. Why? Because we've been found. Because life, our life is a gift. We work for God's kingdom, knowing that that too is pure gift. Remember what Jesus said, do not be afraid, little flock. For it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. To give. It's a gift. It's a gift. Our task is to receive. Not to grasp. Not to snatch. Not to produce. Not to make things happen. But to receive. And to live the abundant life that Christ gives to us. As many of you will know, a good friend of ours died recently, three months ago, somebody we got to know in Margate's. Name was Charlie, he was a few years younger than me, with two teenage sons. Guy who was so full of life, really, really full of life, had a career as a successful financial journalist, was obviously very highly respected in that field, had worked hard and was good at his job, was a devoted father, devoted husband, bit of an entrepreneur, just one of these people with boundless energy and boundless life, and he died. He drowned in a tragic accident, just fishing with his son. His teenage son was with him at the time and managed to get to shore. You hear the word tragedy. This was a tragedy, and at the funeral on the order of service, and I wasn't involved in the funeral in some ways, thankfully, because one of those I'm not sure I'd held myself together. But in the funeral on the top of the order of service, it said this. It said, "Each day a gift. Each day a gift." Now, I've been trying to remember that. I'm trying to remember that each day that we are given is a gift. And maybe that is one of the secrets of life. Recognizing that each day is a gift from God. The people we meet, the people that we will share with, the work that we will do, either the paid work or the stuff we will do at home, the things that will bring pleasure, the things that we will enjoy doing, the things that will frustrate us in a sense, they're a gift. And the life we enjoy in God, the joy of knowing Him, that too is gift, pure gift. Gift from God, a gift from a good, a beloved hand. A gift that is imperishable and undeserved. The joy of knowing God. The joy of God's presence with us day by day. It's all gift. Thanks be to God. Amen.